Blog Talk Radio.
Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law. Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser.
You can't handle the truth.
Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser analyzes criminal cases in the news, trends in the law, and covers all legal current events.
Overruled.
Our host, criminal defense attorney in New York, Daniel Hochheiser. Each week, Talking Law with Dan Hochheiser features newsmakers, attorneys, media personalities, celebrities, politicians, business people, and so much more. Straight talk. No nonsense. Here's Talking Law with your host, Dan Hochheiser.
May 6, 2015, one day after Cinco de Mayo. I hope everybody had a beautiful Cinco de Mayo. And Mark, no, I am not hungover from Cinco de Mayo. I hope our listeners are not hungover and are ready for a great show. I am broadcasting to you live from Lower Manhattan, just east of the Freedom Tower. As our listeners know, I am a criminal defense attorney in New York City, handling all types of criminal cases in the New York City area, from white-collar frauds to murders to drug cases to drunk driving and everything in between. Last week's show was fantastic. We had former Congressman Barney Frank called in to discuss the marriage equality situation case pending in the United States Supreme Court. And you can listen to that show and all our prior episodes at www.blogtalkradio.com/talkinlaw, or you can find the show on iTunes by searching for Talkin' Law with Dan Hochheiser, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-S-E-R. We have another great guest today, Attorney Alan Ellis, who is an expert on federal criminal sentencing law and the inner workings of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Before we get to Alan Ellis, let me tell you what we're going to do today. First, we're going to do the question of the day concerning the United States federal prison population. Then we will speak to Alan Ellis about sentencing, prison, and other issues trending in the criminal justice system. Now, then we will go to the answer to the question of the day before we go to Beth Karras, who will join us with an update on the Eitan Patz trial in New York, the James Holmes Colorado theater shooting case in Colorado, and we may get to talk a little bit about the six police officers recently arrested in connection with the homicide of Freddie Gray. Now, I want to remind everybody, please like our Facebook page, facebook.com/talkinlaw. You can send me an email at talkinlaw@gmail.com. There's no G in talkin. talkinlaw@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Dan Hochheiser, H-O-C-H-H-E-I-S-E-R. Now, for the question of the day. How much has the total population of federal prisoners in the United States increased over the course of the past 35 years? We will have that answer for you after we interview Alan Ellis, who I'm sure knows the answer to the question, but I'm sure he will not give it away. Alan Ellis is the past president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. He is a nationally recognized authority in federal sentencing, prison matters, and post-conviction remedies. He is the primary author of Federal Prison Guidebook, Sentencing and Post-Conviction Remedies, which is currently in its third revision. Alan is scheduled to discuss the Federal Bureau of Prisons 500-hour residential drug abuse program, commonly known as RDAP, in an Association of Federal Defense Attorneys video webinar, which you can check out on Wednesday, May 13th from noon to 1:30 Eastern Time, and you can get the link at www.afda.org. Without further ado, Alan Ellis, are you with me?
Good morning, Dan.
How are you? Thanks for waking up so early. I know you're in San Francisco and must be barely light there.
Just becoming light. Very lovely out here. Good talking to you.
Good. Well, thanks for waking up early. I do appreciate it. We have a lot to talk about. The first thing I want to ask you about is these in November, there are expected to be some changes to the United States sentencing guidelines. Can you tell us a little bit about how those revisions, unless they're blocked by Congress, will change the sentencing scheme?
Dan, on April 9th of this year, the U.S. Sentencing Commission proposed certain fixes, changes, corrections to the federal sentencing guidelines that, unless voted down by both houses of Congress, become law on November 1. And since the guidelines were in effect back in 1987, Congress has only voted them down four times over the hundreds of amendments that have been proposed, and they were in drug cases. So it looks like they're going to sail through.
What types of changes in particular would take effect on November 1st?
The biggest changes are in what we call the economic crimes area, the white-collar crimes area, for example, in fraud. Changes there are that it will take more of a loss to enhance a defendant's sentence. Additionally, there are changes regarding what people are going to be held responsible for. The changes focus on the individual and his individual culpability rather than holding him responsible for others' acts. And those are pretty key. They should be really narrow
and
focused.
What about this? Yeah. What about the issue of what's been commonly known to the federal criminal bar anyway as drugs minus two?
Well, that's already in effect. That was changed last year. The drug guidelines were reduced by two levels. Then subsequently they were made retroactive to all drug inmates currently in federal prison. And effective November 1, judges are empowered to reduce inmates' sentences. And this theoretically could free tens of thousands of inmates because the majority of federal inmates are there on drug offenses, and rather minor ones at that. There's 200,000 people in the federal prison system, half of which are drug offenders.
Let's just back up for a moment and let's explain to the lay people who are listening to the show, because we have listeners who are lawyers and listeners who are not lawyers, what are the United States sentencing guidelines and what role do they play today in the sentencing of a federal criminal defendant?
In 1984, Congress passed the Sentence Reform Act of 1984, which created a commission called the Sentencing Commission, which was designed to establish a range of sentences for offenders who committed similar offenses, who had similar criminal backgrounds, if any. The reason for this, Dan, was that before then, sentences were all over the lot around the country. For example, in the South, an African-American would receive a very stiff sentence for committing the same type of offense that a member of the judge's country club set would receive. And in all fairness, people up in the Northeast might receive much lighter sentences that were being imposed around the other rest of the country. So Congress, in an effort to rein in these judges, either who they perceived as too liberal or too conservative, created the commission and directed the commission to establish sentencing guidelines. And they did, and they came into effect in 1987. And they've been amended, as I said, hundreds of times since then. And they established a range of sentences to be imposed by a federal sentencing judge for, as I say, similar offenses committed by similar types of offenders.
So,
Alan, at one point they were mandatory. Now,
We'll get to now that they're advisory and not mandatory. We'll get to that issue in a minute. But before we get there, in your opinion, and you've been practicing a long, long time, and you've seen the whole life of the sentencing guidelines play out since they were effective in 1987, as you said, And it seems to me that the main purpose of the guidelines, and there are many purposes, but the main purpose was to impose uniformity into the system. So as
yes,
you said,
eliminate disparities.
Similarly situated defendants in different parts of the country who committed the same crimes with similar backgrounds would get similar sentences. So my question to you is, in your opinion, since 1987, has this regime of the sentencing guidelines brought uniformity to sentencing in the United States?
Not really. Not really. At first, judges were required to, for the most part, sentence within the guidelines. They could give a sentence above the guidelines or below the guidelines, but then for only very serious reasons, very, you know, significant reasons. They were pigeonholed. They were enumerated reasons. They were called departures for going above or below the guidelines. And judges went below the guidelines in maybe like 13% of the cases. Above the guidelines, 1 or 2% of the cases. Now, the guidelines, by reason of the U.S. Supreme Court in 2006, are no longer mandatory, they're advisory, and we're seeing more and more judges impose sentences below the guidelines. And frankly, this is as it should be, because sentences have been too high around this country. You know, America has 5% of the world's population, and yet we lock up 25% of the inmates in prison around the globe.
Well, and you spoke about the change from a mandatory guideline system prior to 2006, and I assume you're referring to the Booker case.
Yes.
Now what we have in the post-Booker world is an advisory guideline system where judges, pursuant to a statute called 3553, they're required to consider the guidelines among a variety of other sentencing factors. In my experience since Booker, in my practice, the guidelines are much less important. What have you found in your practice in this post-Booker world? Do the guidelines still matter?
Yeah, judges think look at them as a benchmark, but then feel a lot freer to go above or below them. And as I said, the numbers of cases where they're going below the guidelines is increasing year by year, particularly in fraud cases. In fraud cases, judges find that the guidelines are broken. They need to be fixed. Judges are fixing them by going below the guidelines. And now we see, in response to that, the Sentencing Commission has promulgated changes to the guidelines, fixes we call them.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking with Alan Ellis, federal criminal attorney who is an authority, according to the Ninth Circuit United States Court of Appeals, on sentencing in the federal courts and the Bureau of Prisons. Alan, let's go back to the time when a federal criminal defendant either pleads guilty to a federal crime or is convicted by a jury of a federal crime after a trial. What is the next step in the process before you get to a sentencing?
The offender is interviewed by a United States probation officer who prepares what is known as a pre-sentence investigation report. This is a report that describes the offense, that calculates preliminarily what the U.S. probation officer believes should be the guidelines, and then discusses the offender's characteristics, history and characteristics. Ultimately, after the parties have an opportunity to register objections to it, and the probation officer has to make a finding as to the objections, then goes to the federal judge who looks at it and imposes a sentence.
Now, in connection with the preparation of the pre-sentence report, what many listeners may not realize is that the defendant has an opportunity to submit letters from family, friends, business associates, clergy, whoever, who can write letters in support of the person's character and ask the judge for leniency. In your opinion, how important or unimportant are submission of those types of letters in support of leniency?
Very key. And indeed, with increasing frequency, we're seeing creative attorneys prepare videos that are presented to the sentencing judge prior to sentencing. Videos that show the defendant, that show perhaps the defendant's children. I recently had a case where a client of mine had three minor children, all of whom were suffering from disabilities that they suffered at birth, and we prepared a sentencing video showing our client with his children and argued to the judge that, "Judge, you can't send this guy to jail. Who's going to take care of the kids?" Because he was a single parent at the time.
Well, you know, and I've heard about that being done, and it sounds to me like that could be extremely persuasive at sentencing. Now, for our practitioners who are listening, how did you actually go about producing that video? Is this a situation where you just picked up an iPhone and pressed record, or did you have a professional company help you produce the video? How did you get that done?
There are professional companies out there who do that. Oftentimes, they are videographers, or called videotographers, and they have experience in the area of reporting and editing. So once you do a video, you have to edit it. You have to make it very, you know, entertaining, readable, listenable to the viewable to the sentencing judge. They shouldn't run any more than 10, 15 minutes, because that's what somebody's attention span generally is.
And why is the video sometimes more effective than merely submitting letters in support of leniency or a memorandum from the attorney?
People like to view rather than read, and it's just, it gets the judge's attention. They're unique, and unlike most cases where character reference letters are submitted, this is more effective because you're actually seeing the person who's submitting. Instead of submitting a letter, you actually see the person on video.
Now, let's say, okay, the pre-sentence report is finished, the objections have been made, the judge has ruled on the objections, the judge has imposed sentence, and he's given the defendant, say, 100 months. Now, how at this point does the Bureau of Prisons pick a facility for that particular defendant?
Once the defendant is sentenced, a written sentence called the judgment is handed down by the judge. That gets forwarded to the Bureau of Prisons, and along with the pre-sentence investigation report, the Bureau of Prisons looks at both, looks to see how much time the defendant has spent in custody, if any, so far, and they have a formula, and based on that formula, they decide where to place the offender. And ideally, for an offender, most offenders would want to go to a minimum security federal prison camp, and ideally, an attorney will strive to get his client into such a facility. Not everybody qualifies for those facilities, but that's the end game.
And what can an attorney do? I mean, my experience is that an attorney's abilities and the mechanisms available to the attorney to try to influence the designation is pretty limited. I mean, I know you can ask the judge for a recommendation, but what else can a practitioner do to try to get the person into a camp in California as opposed to a medium security facility in Kentucky?
The Bureau of Prisons policy is to designate or place an inmate at the least restrictive facility for which they qualify, ideally, again, a federal prison camp, as close to their home as possible, which generally means within 500 miles. The key document here is the pre-sentence investigation report. So it's very important for the practitioner to make sure that report is accurate, because if it's inaccurate, the Bureau of Prisons will rely upon it and sentence somebody perhaps to a less desirable or more onerous facility. Additionally, you mentioned earlier, Dan, recommendations from the judge. A well-crafted recommendation by the judge as to a particular facility or type of facility or location of facility, along with a well-crafted rationale in support, and that's where an attorney can be effective by crafting for the judge a well-designed rationale to present it to the Bureau of Prisons, arguing or recommending a particular facility. That can be very helpful as well.
And Alan, for the practitioner, and I'm interested in this, you know, generally when I do my sentencing submission for my client, I'll write a memorandum and I'll include the letters in support of leniency in a package. Are you making a separate letter with containing this rationale for BOP facility designation, or is that part of your memo in support of your sentencing?
Both. Not only do I ask the judge to recommend a particular facility, in addition, I hand up to the judge at sentencing a draft of what I would like the judge to put in the judgment as his recommendation. I find by doing that, oftentimes you'll actually get that worded language you want to have in there as opposed to something else.
Great tip. So the question that I think a lot of our listeners want to know is, let's say somebody, a loved one, is sentenced to 100 months in federal custody. How much of the 100 months does the defendant actually have to do?
Approximately 85%. It used to be, prior to 1984, that with good time, it's called good conduct time now, but before it was called good time, a defendant might serve only 60% of his sentence. Now it's up to 85%. One reason why the Bureau of Prisons is so overcrowded. I won't give away the answer to your question, but
I appreciate that. in any event, let's say so the person is serving their 85% of their 100 months, and they're about to start their sentence. How does a person enter the Bureau of Prisons and get acclimated to an entire different environment, where you don't go to sleep when you want, you have to eat at certain times, you have to report to a job in the prison at certain times? What mechanisms are available to a new inmate in the federal system?
Well, not many. What we do for our clients is we provide our clients, particularly our first offender clients who are going into prison for the first time, who are permitted to voluntarily surrender to the institution designated by the Bureau of Prisons where they should serve their sentence, where they're going to be serving their sentence. We provide a counseling session as to how to do time. It was a chapter in our guidebook on how to do time. We send it to our clients. That's their homework. They'll have to have anybody they want on the conference call with me and one or more of my federal prison consultants who are former BOP officials. And we go over these questions and answers, and the client then asks questions that aren't answered in the book, and we flesh out things that are in the book.
And this is really
client acclimated.
This is really invaluable, Alan. In chapter 4 of your book, it's the heading "How to Do Time," and it has all kinds of advice about initial placement, what to bring, the intake and orientation process, solving problems, advice for family members, information about medical care, all kinds of key advice. And I want to give the opportunity, Alan, to tell our listeners how they can get your book, Federal Prison Guidebook, which is really a must-have for federal criminal lawyers as well as defendants who unfortunately are going to be entering federal custody.
They can order it on our website. Excuse me. They can order it from our website. Our website being alanellis.com, that's alanellis.com.
That's great. And there's going to be a new edition coming out soon as well, is that right?
No, this is a new edition. The 2015-17 edition is the current one. Just came out at the beginning of March. The next one will be out in 2017. And by the way, we've been publishing this. Actually, I started out self-publishing this book in 1998. Several years ago, it was taken over by James Publishing, a very prominent law book publishing company, and it's been published by them, as you mentioned, three times since they took it over about 6 years ago. Comes out every two years.
Well, I think it's a great resource, and I really urge everybody to get it. It's a must-have. Now, let's talk about an issue that always bothers me about the federal criminal justice system, as well as the state criminal justice system, is that one of the purposes of sentencing was always supposed to be and is still rehabilitation. In your view, Alan, over the many decades you've been practicing federal criminal law, what kind of job has the federal criminal justice system done in accomplishing the rehabilitative purpose of sentencing?
A very poor one, Dan, a very poor one. People come out, oftentimes they've been in for too long, and I find that sentences are much too long in this country. As I said earlier, we're incarcerating too many people in this country. And as a result, people are coming out, they're ill-equipped to deal with society, and they revert back to crime. They're
now,
not
Alan,
going to end in prison other than have to commit more crime.
We only have about a minute left, but I just want to we spoke about the changes to the United States sentencing guidelines, which are expected to become effective November 1st. Is there other federal legislation in the pipeline that our listeners should be aware of that may alter or affect the sentencing landscape?
Yes, there's a bill before Congress called the Smarter Sentencing Act, which will do away with many mandatory minimum sentences that require a judge to impose a certain sentence that have been decried throughout the years by many commentators. And now Congress has got into the act, and they're trying to have many of these mandatory minimum sentences, which have caused the prisons to become overcrowded. They're trying to get them eliminated in many cases, or give the judges more discretion to do away with them in many cases. That's been in the pipeline for a few years now. We'll see what happens this year. Right now,
Alan,
we're seeing a bipartisan support for the bill.
Alan, I honestly only got to about half the questions I have for you. I'm going to have to ask you to come back. I hope you will come back on the show soon. And thanks again for waking up early. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome, Dan. A pleasure.
Thank you. Now, we are going to go to the question of the day. How much has the total population of federal prisoners in the United States increased over the course of the past 35 years? We will give the answer before we get to Beth Karras. Answer, in 1980, there were 24,640 inmates in federal custody, while as of April 30th, 2015, there are 208,859 inmates in federal custody. So, what does that mean? Over the course of the past 35 years, our federal prison population has grown by a factor greater than 8. These numbers, of course, do not include the inmates in custody in the 50 different states across the country. For example, as of March 27, 2015, there are 78,618 inmates in New York State custody and 113,700 in California State custody. These exploding prison population statistics in the United States are in part the result of federal overcriminalization and the fruitless war on drugs, in at least one person's opinion, that person being me. Now, give me Beth Karras, give me Kiss.
Talkin' Law Radio brings you a live Karras on Crime special report from Beth Karras, former prosecutor, Court TV, HLN television correspondent, and founder of KarrasOnCrime.com. Now here's Beth with the latest legal news.
Beth, what can I do?
Good morning, Beth.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm fine. Busy following this Colorado theater shooting case. That's what's really occupying my time, even since we last talked. It had just begun last week, and wow, they're cranking it out. 6 days, so, 44 witnesses.
So what's the latest in that James Holmes Colorado theater shooting trial? What should we be looking out for?
Well, the state continues to put on their case in chief, which, I mean, is largely uncontested since it's an insanity defense case, right? I mean, really, he's admitting he did all these acts. Nonetheless, they still have to prove all the allegations. So Victims continue to testify. They're interspersed with police testimony. And also there was a civilian who testified yesterday, a professor in the neuroscience program at the University of Colorado, where Holmes had been matriculated in the PhD program for a year. But he dropped out after the first year when he failed an oral exam. He didn't pass an oral exam. They're going to let him take it again in early June. It was June 7th of 2012. And it appears that he really started to decompensate after that or start to plan the mass shooting because he dyed his hair red only after that. So the professor was on the stand for a while describing the program and basically how sane Holmes was, even though he was a reserved, quiet guy, and the professors thought that he needed to work on his social skills, you know, in presenting, because he would present some of his lab work to groups throughout the year. We heard that. We also heard yesterday how intricately he rigged his apartment with fishing line to trip a thermos of gasoline that was over a frying pan with this potassium manganate, which would have caused sparks. He had soaked his carpet with gasoline. The sparks would have caused the place to, you know, basically go up in flames as soon as somebody walked in. And then he had set his computer to be on 25 minutes silence and then to blare a lot of music. So he was hoping that a neighbor would file a noise complaint, which did happen, get the police to his apartment, cause them to, I guess, enter the apartment or somebody to enter it. It would explode, and then all the responders would be at his apartment rather than at the theater where he would be shooting at the same time. So he timed it so that the noise complaint, if all went well, would come at about the time he's at the theater. And then and the noise complaint came in within the hour before the theater massacre. It didn't work. The noise complaint came in, but the police responded so fast to the theater, within 90 seconds of the first 911 call, 129 first responders were on location. 90 seconds. So it didn't work. They were able to use a bomb robot to defuse some of the stuff in the apartment. So they broke out the window, so if there was an explosion, it wouldn't, you know, glass wouldn't be blown out and injuring people. It was a third floor of an apartment building. And so they were able to safely defuse the apartment. So the jurors saw pictures of all that and heard how intricate it was. I mean, he really wanted to kill as many people as possible.
You're listening to Talkin' Law Radio with Dan Hochheiser. I'm speaking to Beth Karras about the James Holmes Colorado Theater shooting trial, which is in full swing. Beth, you've described a litany of evidence concerning this defendant's planning, premeditation, his seeming sanity since he concocted this very intricate, apparently well thought out, even if it wasn't totally effective, plan. What kinds of things are you hearing? What kinds of information do you expect the defense to rely on to rebut what appears to me to be extremely damaging, perhaps impossible to overcome, evidence that he knew exactly what he was doing?
Well, the defense, they played their cards pretty close to the vest, so we don't know a lot of what they have, except that they may simply be saying it is just so crazy, you know, he was in the middle of a psychotic episode. You know, who in the right mind would do this? There was no history of, you know, his being such a diabolical individual. I expect that jurors are going to get a primer, a tutorial in mental illness, especially schizophrenia, what psychosis is, what a psychotic break is, and how people can be in the middle of a break and still make decisions, you know, knowing right from wrong, for example. Problem is, the law doesn't really keep up with medicine in that regard. I mean, legal insanity is an offensive term, and it's only a term that the law uses, right? Science doesn't, medicine doesn't use the term insanity anymore, but legal insanity is a threshold that may be virtually impossible for them to meet. I mean, the burden's on the state to prove sanity, and there's just so much evidence of sanity under the legal definition. There's ample evidence of mental illness, though, and 20 therapists and evaluators who saw him before and after this massacre all agree he falls somewhere on the schizophrenia spectrum, that he's mentally ill, but mental illness, as we know, does not equal legal insanity.
Let's talk a little bit about the Eitan Patz case in New York, and to remind our listeners, this is the charge against Pedro Hernandez, who is accused of taking this little boy in 1979 in the Village in New York City and killing him. And he was he apparently confessed to some civilians and then ultimately to the police, and the prosecution has relied at the trial almost exclusively on the defendant's confession, which the defense claims is coerced and false. We had a second note from the jury, which is deliberating yesterday, Beth, which said they were deadlocked.
Yes, today is day 16 of deliberations. Now, last time you and I spoke, a week ago, they hadn't issued a deadlock note at the time we spoke, but they did later the same day. So their first deadlock note was a week ago today. And the judge sent them back with an instruction that it would be in everybody's interest, in interest of judicial expediency, et cetera, for them to keep working at it and try to be unanimous. So they asked for the summations on both sides to be read back to them, which was done, and that took at least 2 days. That took Friday and Monday since we last spoke. And they got the summations again, which I've never heard of, but there is case law in New York supporting it. I had to talk to some of my friends from at the DA's office about it. And in addition to hearing the summations, jurors got to watch or see any PowerPoint presentations or videos that were played in the middle of each of those summations. So they were hours, more than, 8 hours, to do all of this for one. So that took a couple of days. And then after the summations yesterday, they came out with their second deadlock note. We don't know what the divide is, but it's got to be more than 11 to 1, whichever way they're going. I mean, it's probably a healthy split. Or maybe most of them say, we just don't know. We just don't have proof beyond a reasonable doubt. In any event, the judge, as you just said, sent them back again to deliberate. And Harvey Fishbein, the attorney, defense attorney for Pedro Hernandez, has been on the airwaves saying, this jury's tired. The judge just has to grant a mistrial. It's over. So,
well,
but
Beth, what stuck out to me is I'm not surprised that my friend Harvey Fishbein is asking for a mistrial. He's doing a great job. What surprised me yesterday is that the prosecutor also objected to the Allen charge that the judge gave to the jury, urging them to continue their deliberations despite their second deadlock note. Tell us a little bit about this unusual objection from the prosecution yesterday, where they were unhappy with the language the judge imparted to the jury about continuing the deliberations.
Dan, you know more about that particular charge than I do. I had been told, but I didn't do enough reading, I guess, about it, that she wanted the jury to go back. This is the prosecutor, that she wanted the jury to go back and continue deliberating, but I didn't realize that she had objected to the particular charge the judge gave them.
Yeah, so let me, in the Wall Street Journal this morning, they quoted some of what the judge said. So the quotes are this: over both parties' objections, I'm going to deliver this, Judge Wiley says. Quote, I'd like you to keep deliberating. You've worked as hard on this case as anybody can work on it. It's safe to say that your verdict, whatever it is, will be second-guessed publicly by any number of people, but please do not be concerned about that. Any verdict reached in accordance with the law and based on the evidence that jurors had heard will be a just verdict. I'm going to direct you to continue your deliberations now. Good luck. And the prosecutor, her problem with that language, apparently, according to the article, is that she thought the judge was telegraphing to the jury that an acquittal was okay.
Yeah, I can see her objecting to that, because my information from people in the courtroom was that the prosecutor wanted the jury to continue deliberating. So when he says over the objections of both sides, I wonder if he's simply making a record that she's objecting to that particular language. But I have to ask. I got to ask her.
I found that very interesting, because generally it's the defense, as we've both seen a lot of times, Beth, who's objecting to an Allen charge, and for the judge asking the jury to try to reach a verdict, because as defense lawyers, we generally rather have a hung jury than risk a guilty verdict, and the prosecution generally is interested in finality. But here
right.
we had objections from both sides, which I thought was quite interesting. I understand that the jury, I think they're going to come back this morning. Do you have any information on that?
No, yeah, I think they'll be back this morning, too. I mean, I'm kind of in touch, since I'm watching the Holmes trial. I'm not down there, but, you know, I'm in touch via email and texting with people who are in the courtroom to sort of get the latest. So, yeah. My information is that they'll be back. Today will be day 16, and I just don't think the judge can let them go that much longer, frankly.
I think today will be the last day. I think at the end of the day, you'll get another deadlock note, and the judge will have to throw up his hands and declare a mistrial. That's my prediction, which is worth at least 2 cents. Now, Beth, I'm sorry.
Next week at this time when we talk, there will be some, we'll have an answer.
Right. So let's talk. We have a couple minutes left, Beth. I want to get your thoughts on the situation in Baltimore. Our listeners, I'm sure, are aware that 6 police officers were charged a couple days ago by the Baltimore State's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, in connection with the death of Freddie Gray, who was the 25-year-old African-American man who ran from the police in Baltimore. He was placed into a police van and died of spinal injuries while he was in police custody. Beth, what did you think about the way that the Baltimore State's attorney handled the charging of these 6 officers?
Well, I thought it was hasty. I mean, she stood before the cameras and said it was a thorough, comprehensive investigation, using adjectives like that, and I thought, how could that be? It's only been 3 weeks. I mean, you never went into the grand jury. I mean, did you talk to any of these officers? Or haven't they all lawyered up? I mean, how much do you really know? And she files the charges on the same day that the medical examiner rules the death a homicide. I mean, I hope she understands a homicide doesn't mean it's murder. But yet she charged murder for the driver. So, I mean, I just thought it was, I have so many questions. I thought it was hasty, and not that there might not be some culpability here, but I thought that it was a political decision and hasty, and I am highly doubtful that she could ever get a conviction for murder and that there should absolutely be a change of venue. And I think there's a conflict with her even prosecuting the case, frankly. I mean, are people talking about Freddie Gray's attorney being on her transition team? I know they're talking about that, but the fact that, you know, will be contemplating a civil suit, and that it is basically, I mean, a civil suit is only about damages if you have a criminal prosecution. I mean, did that factor into her decision to bring a criminal prosecution to help the family of Freddie Gray? I hope not, but it sure doesn't look good.
Well, Beth, we're almost out of time, but I want to refer you, if you haven't seen it yet, and our listeners, to a great blog on this issue by our guest who's going to be on the show next week. It's at Paige, P-A-G-E, Croyder, C-R-O-Y-D-E-R, .blogspot.com, who has an article which is entitled Baltimore's Hasty Prosecutor, and she lays out a very interesting opinion about the missteps that she believes Marilyn Mosby made in charging these 6 officers only 2 weeks after Freddie Gray's death. Beth, thanks so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it. I will speak to you next week.
My pleasure. Talk to you next week.
Bye. Now,
bye-bye.
I want to thank Alan Ellis. Get Alan's book, Alan Ellis, Federal Prison Guidebook, Sentencing and Post-Conviction Remedies. Beth Karras, thank you again. Check out her website, karrasoncrime.com. Mark Goldman, my producer, thank you for doing a great job. Next week, as I said, we will have former Baltimore City Prosecutor Paige Kreuter. She will join us for a discussion of the six police officers charged in the Freddie Gray homicide case. Until next time, next Wednesday, 9:30 a.m., I want to wish everybody peace and justice.